step in making dimethyl siloxanes useful.
What do you have? Should we draw this to a close at a particular time? Do you have
No, I think this lady would stay longer. And
okay, I'll leave that up to you, whatever you...
There's so much of it. We can keep going, I guess.
Okay, it's up to you if you feel that you
whatever, want. I'm okay. Sure.
I was curious. In 38, I think you became manager of the organic lab. How many people did you bring in, and what was your staff like in that very busy period just before the war?
Of course, Johansson had been working with Dr. Green. You may not realize it, but if you get a glass surface completely free of flaws, I've seen pencil-sized glass rod bent into a U. And the reason for it is that you get completely free of flaws. If you've got a flaw in the surface, that concentrates the strain in one place. That goes beyond the strength limit of the material, and if a fly would light on one of those things, it would explode practically. But they were trying to turn out some fortified glassware, and they needed something to protect the surface because that made the glassware stronger. And Johansson was working with, and he was right in our lab there. He gradually moved into the thing. But he saw some of the wetting properties, and he saw some of the monophenol and what it would do, and he thought he'd try it as a primer for ethyl cellulose and some of the other coatings that they wanted to put on glass. So that was really the start of some of this priming business, and that was Kenneth Johansson. It wasn't long before he was working full-time with me. And then it was during 40, there was always a little pressure, and I kept telling Dr. Little, well, we need more people. And so once he was out on a recruiting trip, and it was over to Cornell, and I think this was during 40, Bob Fleming was getting his master's degree in organic chemistry. And he contacted Bob Fleming and invited him over for an interview. And Bob Fleming came to work with us along in that period. And I don't know whether we'd already had the fire and DeLong had gone, but we kept building up, and we needed some people to do analytical work and things like that, because the glassworks analytical aspects were, they were something apart. I mean, they were away from organic chemistry. But then I kept asking for more help, and Dr. Little said, well, you know people up at Harvard. Why don't you call Harvard and see if they've got anyone there that is interested? And I knew Professor Pfizer at Harvard. He was teaching at Harvard at the time, and one of his students that was just graduating was William H. Doubt. And so Doubt came over, and they offered him a job, and he stayed. And along about, now I don't know whether the war had started. It was quite early now that, I can't give you a date. These things crisscross so that, but Julius Torok was the, he was an electrical engineer that had been working on these high tension. He was a man that came to Corning from quite earlier, and one of the things that he did was to, in order to get a test going on some of the resin we were making, what he did was make up some solenoid coils, and then overload them to take the temperature up so he could get a reasonable thermal stability test out of it. And that was, of course, after the war started and before it ended, we had about 15 people, I think, working at Kearney, people doing some analytical work and other bench work, that testing. And along about this time, we had learned how to, one of the critical things, I'll tell you what happened, I can be a little more precise about it, I guess. I wanted to make a batch of a phenylethyl resin for Westinghouse, and that took quite a while. I struggled to get about a pint of it together, and I was bodying it by using HCl. You could also body these things by air blowing, and that's another bad way to do it, because what it was doing was chewing up some of the groups that you had to, went to a lot of trouble to put on there, of course. But what happened was, I think I had one underway, and I went to I used to belong to the Kiwanis Club there, and I went out to dinner. And when I came back, the confounded thing had gelled. And I kept scratching my head over it. I wasn't about to throw that in a scrap jar. And it came to me that it had to be the last cross-linking siloxane linkages that had caused the gelation. And if it'll work, if it'll react with alkali, I can ungel it. And it worked like a charm. A little bit of alcoholic alkali did it. And that was a clue. That was really a clue to some of the behavior that we got into after that. We thought that, well, we got to making some polymers. And I thought, well, here's one thing we can do. If it works that way, we can use stoichiometric amounts of alkali on the dimethyl and make N groups and make any polymer we want. It didn't turn out. If you tried to polymerize some of the material, you would get a gel, and it was necessary. Here, this was a clue to depolymerization. If you want to make a high polymer, you've got to have, it's got to be below analytical, ordinary analytical detection. And so what I found out was that if I put alkali in there with a dimethyl, and heat it up, go up to around 200, 250, that it's a mobile system, and here you'll distill out all of the, and that the alkali ties up the mono, or unsubstituted, and ties it, it's non-volatile, and here you've got a beautiful purification system. And that worked. And that turned out to be a pretty important thing. And after we did that, then we found that we could use a small amount of alkali on these purified cyclics, mostly cyclics. I think they were all cyclics probably under these conditions. You could take a polymer up to pretty good viscosity. But it, and then Johansson came into the picture again. He was actually a physical chemist. And he got into the business of studying. We wanted to learn something about the mechanism and the behavior. So, and by this time, we'd also hired he was a physical chemist too. He worked with Johansson on this polymerization. Gee whiz. Well, anyhow, it wound up that this is a very mobile system, and it's entropy that takes you to the polymer. I mean, it's such a boundary-ranging system that all of them are susceptible, and what you do is wind up with a probability distribution of, of chain lengths, polymer sizes, but we could go up to where it was a perfectly dry plastic gel, which meant a lot of polymers. And we did. So in studying this, I found out that qualitatively I knew that now that it was an ionic reaction because you could speed it up with sodium hydroxide. It wasn't really the sodium, it was the selenolate salt that was formed in situ that was the active polymerization catalyst, of course. And it's a little bit of a polar solvent like acetonitrile would speed the thing up, about 1,000-fold, which was more evidence, of course, that it was an ionic. It may have increased the concentration of selenolate ion in there, too. But then, of course, Johansson got pretty interested and started working on the thing to study rates. And he had Harry, I got the first name, he was a physical chemist too, and they got to studying rates, and it turned out that potassium selenolate was about 500 times faster than the sodium. In other words, the same thing ionized more, and it gave a higher concentration of the actual catalyst, whatever was doing the job. So this got us into making polymers that were halfway decent for making rubbers. And well, let's see.
This was occurring at about the time that Dow Corning was formed?
Well, yeah. This was about that time, and the patent thing was getting to be important now too. And they'd at Corning, they'd hired a fellow by the name of William Blackburn, who was his main job was to get down to get an insight into the siloxane chemistry and the things we were doing and be a part of the patent department out at Dow Corning after it got started. And let's see.
Well, you stayed in Corning during the war. The plant started in Midland about
43. They were during 42. They were already making dimethyl for this oil for the ignition sealing compound. During 42. They were all making that, and so the meeting. When was it? They shook hands and said, we'll have a company?
I've never been able to pin the exact date down on that. The court.
I'm sorry.
No, here we can.
It would be in Colling's book here. Sorry. I think it would be in Colling's book. But anyhow, they started a motor program, too, I think, before Dow Corning was actually formed. George Grant and later John Dichter were involved in that, and I think this was the upshot of Rickover visiting Midland, because he was putting pressure on him to... This would have to be after the war started, it seems to me. And making this ignition sealing compound would have to be after we had this meeting in Littleton's office.
Right.
I didn't finish that. Now there's again. We had learned how to depolymerize, and we were just getting into the business of making halfway decent polymers. And Dr. Britton, he just didn't believe this depolymerization story. And I said, all right, I'll show you. And so when there was a break at noon, I took him over to our lab, and I just put some stuff in a pot and some alkali and heated it up, and he just stood there with his mouth open. It really struck him right between the eyes. He didn't realize. And here was a nice batch of cyclics coming over, and all of the stuff you didn't want staying back in the pot. And this was at the time when Shaler realized that they could make this ignition sealing compound. So that would have to be in 42? His book may Colling's book may tell us. Collings himself, Rickover connection. They were a little bit sparse with their dates in here, I think. I don't see it there. Well, you have one of those books,
yes,
anyhow.
Yes, we can. We'll be able to dig the date out later.
Well, anyway, that was part of the story. And, of course, then they tried to... I've forgotten just how soon the building was up. Would that be in 43?
I think by the end of 43. Because didn't Rickover assist in getting the materials and everything for that building?
One of the things that Rickover did, they needed a water tower, a water tank. And Rickover, I don't know where he tore down something else to get it or what, but he got it for him. And, of course, he was pushing the thing, there was no question about it. That was a long, that motor program, though, was a long, drawn-out thing. I didn't realize at the time, of course, back in around the 40s when we were making this stuff, we figured that the people that know how to make motors would be the ones that would be interested in making a motor. But they kind of shied away from it for some reason or other. I don't know, but when they got going out at Midland, of course, then I began to realize that it isn't just the varnish, it's everything that goes into a motor if you're going to run it at 250 degrees. And they got life tests going, and they had to develop a lubricant, and they had to develop some design changes, and they had to develop slot sticks, and all of the components that go into a motor. And they did this, and then they had a long life test. It didn't get all done till after the war, of course, so it didn't help Rickover much. But I think that now, when you see a locomotive go by, on these diesels, undoubtedly it's got a silicone insulated motor in it, so it paid off in the long run. It was a long, hard haul though. So
when the group started up in Dow in Midland, you still stayed in Corning for many years. What were you doing?
Well,
they were working on pilot plant materials. What were you doing back in Corning?
Well, we were still making polymers and looking for other ways of polymerization. You know, there's an interesting thing, they never used this, but phosphoric acid is a better, it has some interesting possibilities that none of the others have. And I don't know, I guess we have a patent on it probably, but even in the case of sulfuric acid, it is not the sulfuric acid. If you're not careful, it'll clip off methyl groups too. It'll hydrolyze, split them off. But it's the silyl sulfate that is the bond rearranging catalyst, because here it again, though, it is bifunctional, and it's going to get tied into two of them. It's going to be in the middle of something. And the phosphoric acid is the same way. It's trifunctional. But it's an interesting thing. It will not oxidize. Of course, sulfuric is capable of oxidizing too, if higher temperatures. But the phosphate would form a, it's a three-dimensional thing. It could, and it does form a gel when you take it all away and use up the, but the interesting thing is that the doggone gel is soluble in toluene. It's a rather un, but another thing about it is that if you use, and I did work out a an RTV system based on this. I don't think it was ever used, but with the idea that you could use a polyfunctional, put a polyfunctional material in there, and it would replace the phosphate group, and you'd get a cross-linked polymer that would be good for something. And one of the things we tried was, for instance, put ethyl silicate in there. It's soluble, but at higher temperatures it would tend to interact and it would cross-link. And there were ways of putting fillers in that would neutralize the phosphoric acid, and of course calcium phosphate and some of these things probably be pretty good fillers as far as inertness is concerned. So this was another, so this was part of it, of course, and then one of the other things about it was the idea that the phosphoric, you could hydrolyze it, those things are all hydrolyzable, but you could hydrolyze it and wash out the phosphoric and put silanol groups in place of it, which... And I've forgotten now whether we did some, I think we made some of the first RTVs. You know, when the hydroxyl groups diminish in concentration, you begin to, well, an engineer might ignore it, but if you got a, something that's 5,000 units long and you probably can't find the hydroxyl group, but it's still there in a functional group. And this was the basis of making some of our RTV systems, the recognition of the fact that the silanol group is there, and you can still do tie a, for instance, if you have a longer chain polymer and you react it with the monomethyl triacetoxy, one acetoxy group will react with the silanol group and put a diacetoxy methyl N group in there, but those other acetoxy groups are still moisture sensitive, and they'll hydrolyze and they're polyfunctional and they'll give you a cross-link. And that was, this kind of thing is the basis for, we got a number of different kinds of compositions now, of course, but that was the basis of trying to find hydroxyl groups. And always I was trying to, I realized the probability distribution of these things and where you have an active boundary arranging system. It bothered me that you couldn't get a more accurate structure, build a more accurate structure. So quite a bit of the work that I continued to try to do at Corning was to be able to do this sort of thing. And of course we did a lot of back and forth. I used to go out almost once a month sometimes, and we'd have fairly frequent symposium. But we'd get together and talk about problems and discuss what we'd done and where it might fit into the whole pattern.
And did Warwick and McGregor get, did you all, did three groups meet together? Because they stayed in at Mellon until through the war, at least, before they went to...
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten whether... one of the first things that happened was that we gradually reduced things at Corning, and Corning was getting to the point where they thought, well... After the war, of course, they didn't have any customers. That created a problem for them. But as things went on and they began to get good business, Corning felt they ought to be paying their own way and paying for what was being done at Corning. So we gradually moved things out there. Johansson went out first, and he was the one that had some good know-how on the potassium polymerization. And they were making it in batch quantities, but they were making better rubber now because they could make higher polymers that were more suitable. You've got to have pretty high polymers if you want good working properties on a rubber mill. And that's one of the things that we got out of the alkali perimerization. Later on, Jack Worley working with me, one of the first things that Jack and I did together was make a continuous polymerization gadget where we'd feed the catalyst and the raw materials, the hydrolysate, into one end of this thing, and it was fast enough we could take polymer out the other end. And when Colling saw this, it changed their... They started building bigger ones. He never said anything to me, but I'm sure, because they were using these bigger Perkin mixers up to that time, you know, these dough mixers. But it wasn't long before the engineers were building a continuous system. And the potassium was 500 times faster than the sodium, and so that gave them the speed you needed. You could get it with the sodium catalyst by putting an acetonitrile in there. Of course, that complicates things, makes it more difficult. But another interesting thing that occurs in this polymerization, because of the mobility of that system, when you gradually, after, well, even if as it stands, the least soluble component in there is a short chain like the dimer salt. And that starts crystallizing out, and what that does means is that you've got the salt comes out and you're tying two other big molecules together. That has something to do with the polymerization systems. There's no doubt about it. But it's still... then, of course, the... I think I've explained that in here too. That I've forgotten just the last things that we did at Corning. Then we at Corning, when I realized that we were going to have competition, way back I realized or I felt that we could use organic groups to control structure. And when I realized that that GE was going to be in the business too, I got, by this time I had Ken Johansson and Bill Dowd and Bob Fleming and Joe Domicone, another person. We got together and we made all kinds of monodi and tri-substituted intermediates, and then we used specific on predetermined amounts of monodi and tri to make different structures and put them together. By the time we got through, we had 125 examples. I was going to make sure that Rockow and these guys didn't walk off with something. And that was a good thing, because later on, that's the way we made some of our resins and still make some of our resins out there. I think that we would have missed the boat if we probably hadn't done that. But the result of that was that they put in a patent, but it had to be broken down into a number of patents later on. And so the amphoteric character of these things gets into the picture too. Before I got the story there pretty well. I don't know whether we can keep on going.
It's up to you. Well, I'm going to have to change the tape.